All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going with you? You all right? What's happening? You freaking out? I'm not freaking out today. I'm happy to be back home. Tom Papa is on the show today. Tom is a comedian I've known for a long time, started a few years after me, but I've known him forever. We've never sat down and talked in here. I've had to, I projected a lot of stuff onto Tom in the past. I just never could get a handle on where the fuck he was coming from. And I kind of need a handle on where the fuck you're coming from if I'm going to engage with you more than a few times. So I decided a few things about him that weren't true. And I was kind of an asshole to him a few times, but he's one of those guys that just kind of knew who I was and knew the kind of person I was, and it didn't really affect him that deeply. It kind of rolled off him. There are people that have dealt with me over the years that they see me coming, and they're like, all right, gird her up. You have to deal with this guy, this guy whose brain is on fire, and he's got to say something horrible to me in a few minutes. But that didn't really have an effect on him, and I was happy to get to know him and make a mild amends in a couple places, but he's a great guy, great comic, and we had a nice conversation. You'll hear that momentarily. Thank you all for some of the nice emails about the Neil Brennan episode. We got down to psychological, spiritual, and emotional brass tacks, kind of hashed it out. Sometimes that's good. It was very focused, had an agenda in a lot of ways, and I think we covered a lot of turf, a lot of ground, a lot of the inner landscape, and got a couple emails from people who are like, man, I never thought about that. And you just shook something loose forever. One guy wrote an email, where the hell is that? Subject line, Neil Brennan, that's all. Mark, your interview with Neil was beautiful. Great job. It never occurred to me that my parents never really had the capacity to love or be loved. You guys answered a lot of questions that have had me puzzled for decades. My sincere thanks, John. Decades. It's interesting when something shakes loose like that, when the lens just shifts, when just one little thing is thrown into the head and everything changes about how you saw who you were or how you came to where you are. It's a very thrilling thing when it sticks, you know what I mean? Unfortunately, having the brain open to that kind of thing, a lot of things could be thrown in there that stick that are just fucking terrible and make you do terrible things and, perceive reality as something completely other than what it is and take action in relation to that delusion. So be wary of those. But if something just shakes something loose and makes things a little easier for you to understand for yourself and your heart, well, good, great, glad to help out. So I'm back in the garage, the new garage, and I got to tell you, folks, those of you who are concerned, this place is going to be great. I don't even know why, really. I mean, it's a different space. It's filled differently. It's shaped differently. Had some sound issues that are, working themselves out. But again, it's a podcast. I don't need a soundproof room. But there's something about this space that's different than the other space. The other space, as great as it was cozy. It absorbed sound nicely. It was cluttered on the floor, on the walls, the ceiling. It was smaller. But there was a lot going on. But there's something that's happening here. There's a focus that's happening in here. The vibe is, we're here to do this. We're here to talk. We're here to have this experience where we talk to each other. There's not a lot of distractions. There's not a lot of chaos on the margins. And there's just something about the way I'm focusing in here and the way the guest is sort of focusing where the conversations are longer and they seem like they could go on even longer than they have been. I'm doing long talks in here. I don't know if it's something more relaxing here or there's something more grounded about this space. I mean, the old space was just a history of me and my chaos and things I was holding on to. This is maybe just an evolution, or maybe it just feels a little more grounded in here, and I'm fucking digging it. So I'm back. I'm back from Birmingham, and I think I can tell you what was happening if you didn't assume or figure it out. I was shooting a little movie. We shot it out in like 2 weeks. Lynn Shelton directed. She wrote it with Mike O'Brien. Funny guy, but it's sort of a different type of movie for Lynn. Certainly a different type of movie for me. It was an odd story that required the South as a backdrop. There was a lot of interesting characters. It was a completely improvised movie that featured me, Michaela Watkins, Jillian Bell, John Bass, Toby Huss came down and shot a bit. Tim Paul, Whit Thomas, a comedian that I'd met but didn't remember, and Dan Bachdahl. Is that how you pronounce his last name? Bachdahl, I think. From you might know him from Veep. Very funny guy. It was just sort of like this kind of insane, improvisational kind of a. It's kind of a comedy, but it's kind of rings a little true. I mean, it's an odd little film, and it was shot with a lot of sweat. A lot of sweat and angst. Not too much angst, but I get uncomfortable in humidity. And when you got to shoot a scene in the back of a truck for 12 hours in a marginally air-conditioned space, and you're just kind of coated with a glaze of fucking damp sweat the whole time. It's not The Revenant. You know, I'm not in the Arctic or in the wilderness. I'm not eating raw liver to make sure there's authenticity to the part, but it's a little uncomfortable. But all in all, it was a pretty great time and a pretty interesting movie, and I'm looking forward to seeing what Lynn cobbles together out of the footage we shot, man. I mean, fuck. A lot of stuff going on. And when you improvise a movie, it was pretty awesome. It's a lot different than, okay, where do I stand and say my line and get behind that line? It's sort of like, you got to be all in for this shit. And I was working with geniuses, fucking comedy geniuses, the lot of them, every one of them, Dan, Jillian, John, Tim, Toby, Whit, Michaela, who I've worked with before, fucking genius. But it's a good experience. And now that I'm back and I'm sort of still working on my new house, and I've decided to do a sugar detox because I'm carrying a lot of the South with me right now, just above my pants, just above the belt line. I feel a little bit of the South hanging over, just a bit of the South on the sides, spilling over my belt line a bit. And not that I don't love the South. My love for the South doesn't need to be expressed through love handles. You dig, man? All right. We on the same page. Also, I don't want to neglect or forget to give a shout out to the entire crew of Sword of Trust. Did I even mention the name of the movie? That's the name of the movie. Sword of Trust, and everybody who worked on it from top to bottom was just a pleasure. And I realized, man, you know, if you like doing something, a lot of times, maybe this is just me, when you do it for work, you may forget that you like it, even though you like it, and that's why you do the work. So try to remember, when you're doing something you like, to continue liking it if you're fortunate enough to do something you like for a living. Does that make sense? When things become a job, you risk the possibility that you will not like it anymore because it's a job. But try to remember that you liked doing the job and it's what you do. Or else you get into a fucking dark hole. Or else you're just a complaining asshole. Or else you're just someone who's incapable of having a good time. A, B, or C. All of the above. You know what I'm saying. So here's the other thing I wanted to tell you, because I don't know. I don't know that it's important. But I've become obsessed. You know when you have an album for years, you know an album, or it's just there, and you know, everyone amasses so much music that you forget to focus in on everything because you got thousands of things. But I was on the plane, and I wanted to have stuff on my phone. I was just picking things at random, and I'd pick Planet Waves by Bob Dylan, a record that I haven't paid enough attention to or much attention to in years, even if I processed it then. I don't know that I really did. Whatever the case, my point is out of nowhere, you know, after years, you know, that's just become my favorite Bob Dylan record. I don't know. It's not even a matter of missing it. It's just a matter of sometimes, and I've said this before, you have artists that their stuff just grows with you, or it sneaks up on you, or takes on a different meaning as you get older. It morphs along with you. It sort of shapeshifts, or it evolves, or it becomes something different for you as you become older or evolve or regress or whatever. When music isn't limited to nostalgia and you give it some space again, you can be blown away. And I've gotten obsessed with Planet Waves to the point where I'm amassing copies of the vinyl. I went out and bought two yesterday. I'm going to go pick another one up today, and I'll probably get as many as I can. Then it's not an expensive record. People don't seem to give a fuck about the record. I bought a sealed copy of it from 74, and it was $10. But this is an album that he made around 73, 74, I think, with the band. I didn't realize that Dylan had only done two records with the band, and a live one, and The Last Waltz. And fucking miraculous record. The space that that band finds amongst each other to just fill together in some sort of strange, unified beauty that it just doesn't happen that often. And Dylan, right at that moment, it was just complete symbiosis of perfectly American music. And it was just, I don't know, man. I can't stop listening to fucking Planet Waves by Bob Dylan. Maybe you should give it a try. Maybe you'll get excited too. But just listen to that band and listen to where they're at and listen to fucking Levon and Rick and Richard and Robbie and Garth and just, I mean, wow. Danko and Helm, man. That fucking rhythm section. God damn it. Anyway, that's what's going on with me. Anyway, Tom Papa, his new book, Your Dad Stole My Rake and Other Family Dilemmas, is now available for pre-order. It comes out June 5th. Had a lovely talk here in the new garage with Tom, and this is... Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
That's it.
We didn't start out together. You started later than me, right?
I started in 93.
Right, later, right.
Yeah.
Because I remember seeing you. I remember for some reason, I didn't know what to make of you.
I know you didn't.
is that true? You mean you could feel that?
Yeah, 100%.
What do you think it was?
I don't think anybody that did stand up in the beginning in New York didn't have a Marc Maron litmus test. you run into people, and there's some people you run into, and you're like, well, that guy sizing me up, and he's not telling me what he thinks.
You just appeared out of nowhere. You looked kind of, conservative-ish or something. I can't remember how you struck me. I didn't know what to make of you. And I just remember I think you were a little heavier.
A little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And you kind of hung around, and I remember seeing you at Caroline's, and then I remember I don't know why I never could figure out who you were.
Yeah,
that's the thing. It's sort of like I don't know if you were playing your cards close to your chest, or maybe you're just that guy.
Yeah.
As time goes on, I realize you're kind of that guy.
It's interesting because I literally would think that about you. I'm honest. I would think he doesn't know who I am.
Did that affect you in any way? Like maybe I should do. I mean,
I carried you around a little bit, not too much though, because you seemed so balled up with yourself.
Yeah,
that it wasn't like I never like I knew maybe I wasn't cool enough in your eyes. Yeah. Or maybe there was like who is this guy? Yeah. Kind of a vibe, but I didn't carry you like the weight of you around like some other people.
I guess some people did. It turns out that I was just an aggravated, self-involved person. What are you looking surprised about?
Yeah. Because you were you would take shots once in a while for sure
at other guys.
I told you no, like just interacting with you, it'd be like, you know.
Oh yeah. What did you tell me? I can't remember.
It's like hanging out with like a pet that you don't really know.
Yeah. Like this one's like, a little wild.
You're like, oh, this is cool. He's letting me scratch behind his ears. He just bit my finger. Why'd he do that? And then he's gotten out the back door.
What was the story you told me? I remember it's not a good one. It's not a great story. I know it doesn't make me look good.
No, it doesn't make either of us look that great. No, we were fine. Yeah. But it was just one of those moments. I got a early TV pilot.
Yeah.
It's
one of these stories.
On NBC. And it was very, very early.
Yeah.
And I ran into you out here. It was the first time we were at in the hallway of the improv.
Oh.
Yeah. And I came off stage and you were the only one in the hallway and you said something like, what's this? What's going on? And I said, you know, doing this TV show. Oh. I said, why does that bother you? You said, no, I mean, it makes sense that you're doing it. I just don't think you deserve it. But it made me laugh. You made me laugh the way Kevin Brennan would make me laugh.
Right.
Like, some people would be like, F that guy. What?
Right.
I always took it as it was you.
But I kind of remember that. And I remember, like, because that's a kind of interesting part of who I was then was that there were certain moments where I would choose to say something awful.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way to interpret that as like, it's not a coded thing. You're not
no.
What does that mean?
No subtlety.
No subtlety at all.
No.
But I clearly meant to, you know, just be like, fuck you.
Right, exactly.
You know, like right to your face.
Yeah, I don't have it.
For no reason.
You've got a nibble. I haven't gotten a nibble.
Right.
Screw you.
But like it was a buildup of this sort of like not being able to get a handle on your personality or understand, you know, like, you know, you were one of those guys in my mind. It's like, what is he doing? How do people get a sense of that guy?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't even know if I really was paying attention to your act at that time, you know, and it wasn't until not too long ago that I just started paying attention to this sort of long form kind of accessible, but you know, very well crafted shit you were doing.
Right.
You know, and I don't know if you were doing that at the beginning. I can't remember.
No.
There was just always something. I took your personality at that time, which is not that different than it is now, as sort of like glib and artificial.
Right.
And I don't, you know, just kind of like, hi, how's everyone doing? I'm like, what the fuck is he doing? You know, like,
but, why is he being so friendly?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's genuinely who you are.
Yeah.
It took till like, you know, last year for me to realize it.
Yeah. Well, in the beginning, it's just, you know, there was no craft. I mean, you know, I think.
No,
I think Attell said to me early on, like, yeah, eight years. Like he put 8 years in my head that's when you really start to kind of figure it out.
Well, that's what I remembered about you is that you were one of those guys. And, you know, in Giraldo, too, I think. You guys must have started at the same time-ish.
Exactly the same time.
Right.
Well, he started, like, a little before. My first time on stage was me and him in a bringer show at the New York Comedy Club.
No kidding.
Upstairs from that cowboy bar at the time. And it was June 12th, 1993.
Hold on.
It was like a Western bar downstairs.
Which New York Comedy Club was that?
It was upstairs.
Holy fuck. I don't even know if I remember that one.
A small spot. I brought five friends, and there was probably seven people in the audience. And a very-
Including your seven?
Including my five.
Your five?
Yeah.
So five of the seven were yours?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And it's at like 5 p.m, like in June,
yeah.
You know? So
yeah.
It's like it's light out.
It's horrible. People are sweaty.
I had to leave New Jersey at 3:00. And I walk in and there is a very extremely nervous, clean-shaven, sweaty Greg Giraldo.
Yeah.
Hey, man, what's going on?
Yeah,
you
so
doing
nice.
Spots? You good to do it?
Yeah.
And I did my first spot and then Greg and I just, that was it. We were like brothers. He was just...
That's
so
what,
great.
Yeah, kind of connect you two. He was you know, a little pudgier then.
He was. He was a little doughier. And I would do shows with him and Gaffigan. That was kind of the...
He started the same time you two?
Yeah. I think him and Greg had started just like 6 months before I did. And then I...
What year is this?
1993.
Really?
June 12th, 1993.
Right. So you guys came in... That's right. I remember
when did you start?
Gaffigan seemed more albino-ish then.
Yes.
Didn't he?
Yes, completely.
Like, he was almost freakish. And you're I think it was because of the glasses.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't wear them anymore. And that's the only, because he can't look that much different.
Yeah.
But I think he used to wear those frames. And somehow or another, you'd see him and you're like, what the fuck is with that? It's like albino.
And he, in his act, he had the thing, like that second voice thing.
Yeah, like the Kevin Meaney thing.
Yeah. What's he doing?
Yeah, what's he doing?
But he didn't have like... The other part of just being Jim.
Right.
So he would just be this big albino guy walking back on stage going, boochie, 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 making these weird noises. And I was like, what's going to happen to that guy?
Where's that going?
Yeah. And then
he was like an ex-football player. He was bigger. He was heavier then, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know why that's the theme.
I know. Everyone was fatter chubbier. Then,
yeah. But that, I think that's what I remember, is that you and Geraldo specifically just hanging around, sponging the energy. You know what I mean? Like taking it all in.
Oh, completely. Like, we just could not believe that we were doing it. We just could not believe that. And the crazy thing about stand-up that I realized, because I had acted in school and I was like, maybe I'll try and get parts, but I always had wanted to be a comedian. And the first time I did stand-up, it was like, oh, this is like a backdoor into...
You're
like,
that guy.
Like, yeah, I don't have to get hired
and get, I can get, to on, get stage on stage all the time. Yeah.
I can get on stage. And John Stewart and Grace Brett Butler. Yeah. Brett Butler, whose her show was Grace.
Grace Under Fire.
I was hosting and they were on the show.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is amazing. Like, I could not believe you were around these people. Like, you could share the stage with them.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Greg. And I quit for, I did it for like a year and then quit.
For how long?
For like, probably like 8 months.
So let's go back then. So, you know, the real desire was to be an actor. I mean, you know, ultimately coming out.
I wanted to be a stand-up as a kid. Like, from the time I was
Where'd you grow up?
In New Jersey.
Yeah? What part of New Jersey?
Northern New Jersey.
Do you feel like I'm from New Jersey?
No.
I was born in New Jersey.
You were?
For 6 years of my life, New Jersey.
Where?
Pompton Lakes.
Oh, Pompton Lakes.
Morris County.
Yeah, it's not that far.
No, it's not far from you, right?
Yeah. No, where you have a little Jersey.
Oh, yeah. I'm genetically Jersey all the way through.
Yeah.
Both my parents, Jersey. Jersey City, Pompton Lakes.
Yeah, Jersey City was my mother.
Oh, really?
Yeah, as a kid.
Yeah. What kind of background are you?
Italian and one German.
German and Italian?
Yeah, my one grandfather was German, the other three Italian.
Oh, yeah? Mostly Italian.
Mostly Italian. I feel Italian. I don't feel German.
What town?
Woodcliffe Lake, Park Ridge, Montvale.
Oh, yeah?
Up there.
Like nice.
The border of New York and New Jersey.
Jersey's pretty. I've grown...
Jersey's nice.
The more I think about it, the more I grow... Like, I remember going, visiting from New Mexico to see the grandparents and aunts and uncles.
Yeah.
And in the summer, you get the big tomatoes.
Yeah.
And it was like almost like hazy from the humidity.
Yeah.
And so
very lush, so green.
So green.
I know, incredibly green.
Yeah.
And the beautiful beach.
Like pretty state.
It's really nice. The problem is people come into Newark Airport and you drive on that turnpike at that same time of year, and the sky
Nightmare.
Is orange.
Yeah, Newark, Elizabeth, Patterson's not great. I mean, there's definitely areas
in
Jersey. They're definitely rough.
I know. But as a kid, I could see the Empire State Building from my little desk.
Oh, really?
Like, you could see it in the distance.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to be a comedian. I always wanted to be a comedian. And then
why?
And then when I went to... I was very funny as a kid.
Yeah.
And... then I listened to comedy albums. I had this one week.
Yeah.
I listened to Let's Get Small with my friend's older friends.
They turned you on to it?
Had no idea that he sings Grandpa Bought a Rubber. I had no idea what a rubber was,
but
I saw all the older kids laughing. I was like, wait, this is a job? And then I went to my friend Joe's house later in the week, and his father had given him Class Clown.
Oh, yeah.
And we sat in his basement.
Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits.
Yeah, I was like, all right. I'm funny. These guys make a living out of this. And that just started the whole, like, just started my thinking.
So what was that kid's name? So-and-so passed an entire cheese sandwich through his nose. Sister so-and-so thought it was a miracle.
Yeah. So crazy. Just the cover of him, just like this hippie, like, with the fingers up his nose. It's like, yeah. So I just, you know, as a funny kid, and I just want to do that. But then when I was in college, I was acting. I just started acting. I played football my whole high school.
Really?
I wasn't an arty kid.
So did Gaffigan, right?
Yeah, Gaffigan played.
You played football?
Yeah. My father was big football guy. Big time football guy.
So you're a sports fan now?
I'm a baseball fan now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like a lot? Like you look forward to it?
I really love watching.
Is it happening now?
Yankees, yeah.
Is it happening?
It's happening right now.
Yeah? Yeah. So you watch the games?
Like, I watch games. I keep them on. I like, this is my level. I like that I can read while watching a game.
Because you just listen and we hear the clack of the bat.
Yeah.
Like,
hey! You look up. Totally. I can't really focus on basketball.
But we hear that clack. You're like, oh,
hey, where we go? Ooh. I really love that. So, I love, like, you could sit with a paper and watch it.
What position?
I was a fullback. I ran. Mm. But I started in kindergarten.
Yeah?
And my a father, lot of pictures that was of you? Like my connection with my father. Like, we.
So you had one.
I would work
if
out.
If it started in kindergarten.
Yeah.
You had a connection.
I did.
All the way.
Yeah.
You have siblings?
He's a tough guy.
Yeah?
Two younger sisters.
Oh, so you were, it was on you.
Yeah. It was all me. All me all the time. And by the time I got to high school, I was like, I am, you know, enough of this.
I'm tired of wearing pads.
And I went to Ryder College in New Jersey.
But your dad, though, he was a big guy?
He was a big, yeah, forearms.
Still around?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I call him the tank.
Yeah.
He's got these forearms.
Yeah.
Just like, you would like him. He's a no bullshit guy, yeah. Tough.
Is he's Italian?
Approachable, yeah.
Is he the full
Sicilian.
Italian? Yeah?
Yeah, his parents are both, yeah, Sicilian.
Uh-huh. And, like, what did he do?
He was in sales for, like, early internet communications companies, but he did very well. He came from nothing,
yeah.
Six brothers and sisters,
yeah.
No money,
yeah.
Worked his way up,
yeah.
Did this sales thing, made good money doing it, hated it.
Yeah.
And he had like these sideburns and yeah. He would go to like these conferences and he'd put up perverted slideshows because he thought it was funny and he's not a funny guy really. No, but there was a rebel to, he rode motorcycles.
Oh yeah.
He was not a corporate guy, but he needed to make money for his family and did that. But I always got the sense like he wants out.
Oh really?
Yeah. He wants out.
Was he angry?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's very sweet, a complex guy, like yeah. Very sweet, but then the anger would, boom.
Right away?
Come up. Yeah.
Yeah. In the house?
In the house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Outside.
Outside the house.
At restaurants.
At restaurants. In the car. Yeah. Like, you don't,
never
you
knew
didn't
when it was...
mess. You did not mess. It was like when you.
Was there a beat where you're like, oh no.
When it was, when I'm, the phrase is, I'm going to tell your father or your father's almost home.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Horrible.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys get along now?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What about your mom?
She was funny.
Yeah.
Oh, she's still funny.
Yeah. You got to be when you're living with a monster.
Yeah, an intense guy. And they met in high school.
Uh-huh.
And he's very quiet and stuff. And she was a goofball doing voices.
Oh, really?
Imitating everybody from like our life. She was fun. And her father was very funny. My grandfather.
Did they ever do anything?
Storytellers.
Oh,
very,
yeah?
Very much like. Could light up the room, kind of.
Oh, yeah?
Capture everybody. Yeah.
What'd your mom do when you were growing up?
She raised us and then went back to school. And she got her degree while we were going through like junior high and high school. And
in
then
what?
Then she ran an advertising company, a small ad agency.
So yeah. She got you guys out of the way and then, you know.
Yeah, she kept doing it. She always had her little eye on.
Uh-huh.
Like there was like feminist stuff going on. And she's very kind of sweet, soft-spoken. But she was always like. Thinking about feminist stuff and wanted her own business and got her own business. And
advertising's kind of creative.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
They together
she
still?
She could write. She's a writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. She could tell stories. You
yeah.
Know?
So well, was, advertising requires writing.
Yeah. But
they
then you
still
start
together.
Then you start doing like your clients or nursing homes and stuff.
Yeah. You can't like, get too funny.
Yeah. Right. It can't
you're
be
almost
too
dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are they still married?
Yeah.
Oh.
In their 70s, married, still taking motorcycle trips.
Really?
Yeah.
So they ride together or she gets in
she
the
gets on
thing?
The back.
Oh, she does?
Yeah.
Oh, that's sweet.
They've done the whole, all of Europe, all of the U.S.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's kind of nice.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Like Harley? What's your,
they still
what
go.
Kind of bike?
Harleys. He's all Harleys.
All Harley. Does he hang around with a bunch of other old guys who
yeah.
ride Harleys?
Yeah. And the, you know, he would go on this trip in June every year.
Yeah.
And I started riding after college.
You ride?
I did, yeah.
No more.
No. Out here with kids. A career.
Scary.
Scary.
So is that something else that you and Geraldo bonded over?
Yes. Geraldo and I used to, we had bikes in the city at the same time.
I remember.
And we would go park them. Like we'd go from, that was the first time we could easily get from the strip to the cellar.
On the bike?
Because remember, it was such a shit show to get down there.
Oh, yeah, because you can
expensive.
And you had like, you know, half hour between spots, and you had to like traverse the entire expanse of the vertical of New York.
Yeah.
You know, to get from Bleecker to fucking, you know, like 90, what is it?
Like 76
on the east side.
Yeah, on like 2nd Avenue. Yeah, it was like there's no trains going
to
help
you. If you had to go to stand up New York, that's like at 95th or something.
Yeah.
Where the hell was stand up?
That was 78th in Broadway.
Oh, but over. Yeah.
But the seller forget, and you know, we had no money. We needed that $10 you got for your spot. We couldn't pay for a cab.
Right.
$25 cab.
So you guys had both.
So when we got
bikes?
Motorcycles, it was the coolest. We could just cruise down and.
Would you ride together, like, you know, on separate bikes?
Once in a while.
Yeah.
But normally, you know how you're running spots.
Louis had one too for a while.
Just meet up.
And Louis had one, and then he fucking got in that horrible accident. It's usually what happens to people, why they quit riding. You're like, maybe I don't want to be in a wheelchair. Fucking dribbling.
I know.
As
you know,
my kids get older.
Yeah. Before the kids thing, it was when I started getting, you know, a career as a stand-up. And I was like, I don't want to limp on the stage. I don't want to have to limp.
Like Jimmy Schubert?
Like a cane.
Schubert's a motorcycle limp.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I heard he got it fixed. I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you know Jimmy?
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
I heard he got it fixed. Yeah. Motorcycles are rough. All right. So your dad, you know, they go on June. And
so I would do those trips with him all the time.
And you had a Harley too?
And no. Everyone was Harleys. And I couldn't afford a Harley, so I bought a Yamaha Virago. It's a Japanese bike that looks like a Harley.
So it's a road bike.
It's a road bike.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. It was like a cruiser. It looked cool.
Yeah.
It was good, and they would bust my balls, but they broke down every trip. They would break down.
At the Harleys?
And people would come up, you know, from like, Tennessee and be like, why are you letting this guy ride with you?
Yeah.
I'm sitting there on my little Honda.
That's still running.
My Yamaha.
The one that's not
like,
broken.
That's what my line was. Somebody's got to go for parts. But it was cool. And I kind of feel like that's, my father's still going. And I don't ride anymore. And I know he really wants me to. Like, it's kind of the reverse father-son thing.
But I would be terrified. You know, I'm terrified to walk on a sidewalk with people texting. And, you know,
yes.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, all it takes is some guy to just, like, go over 3 feet.
Oh, I know.
And then, you know.
I know.
But it seems like highway riding, you know, once you get out in it, is a little safer.
Yeah, and country roads.
Yeah.
You know, he's been doing it so long. I just can't now. You know, but I feel like that would be a cool thing.
Yeah.
He really wants me to. We had football for a long time, then we had
motorcycle
bikes for a long time, and now we just talk on the phone.
Right. I guess that's what happens.
Yeah.
But all right. So you're in Jersey.
Yeah.
And you go to college, and you're acting, and what? Like, what, are you
plays.
Taking it seriously?
I am taking. I'm totally taking it seriously.
Are you studying theater?
I'm studying theater.
That's what you're majoring in?
No, I'm majoring in communications, but I go to Rider because they have no football program. They were banned from football.
Oh.
They cheated.
Like,
they
there's
did
not
something.
Even, no one can pressure me. No one, not even me out of guilt can do it.
100%.
Right.
And I knew they had a theater department.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll go there.
Uh-huh.
And I started studying. I had these really good teachers, and I was in all the plays, and I just loved it. Everything else was just fell aside.
Yeah, like what kind of plays?
I did All My Sons.
Uh-huh.
I did Dracula. I did Equus.
Really? That's heavy.
It was heavy.
Did you play the kid or the doctor?
I played the doctor. An 18-year-old kid imitating Richard Burton. Trying to pretend that I smoke.
Yeah.
It was, you know.
Wow.
But I learned a lot, and I love, and but more than like learning how to act, it was that I became confident that I could live this lifestyle
on
like
stage somehow. Yeah,
growing up with salespeople and all this other people in my life and no one in the arts.
Yeah,
I just remember. I remember like at a we had rehearsal for this play. It was like dress rehearsal was coming down to the thing,
mm-hmm.
And we lived off campus. My friends and I had this house. And they were having this great big party that they were planning. And I was at the Wawa after rehearsal.
Yeah.
The 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
Getting a sandwich, knowing that the party was going on.
Yeah.
But no, like kind of in my head going over my lines, I'd just gotten out of rehearsal. And there was no rush in me to get to the party.
Yeah.
I remember standing in that Wawa thinking, this is what it is to be an actor. This is what it is to be in the arts somehow.
Yeah, right.
I have no, I just, getting my sandwich by myself, thinking about my
yeah,
lines.
Yeah.
And I, that moment was
and not
like,
wanting to go to the party.
Yeah, not, I'll get there, whatever. Yeah.
It's but that's be, also what makes you a comic. You're like, you're not like, I got to get to the party. You're like, this is good. I got my thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to eat my food and that's that.
That's right. That's a very big moment, yeah, you know? Because you realize, no, they're chasing something, but I found something.
Right.
It's kind of how I felt.
Yeah. Did you graduate?
I did.
Yeah.
I graduated, and I went on one interview for in an ad agency.
Yeah. At your mom's? And she didn't hire you?
No. I actually ended up working for her.
Oh, really?
After this.
Yeah.
Right when I graduated, because I had no money.
Yeah.
I went on an interview because I figured I'll go to New York and be in advertising. That was the thing I was maybe I was supposed to do. And I went and I met with a guy in a cubicle and he's there in his suspenders and he's miserable and he's asking me mean questions. And I'm in a wool suit in the summer, like in the heat. And I'm like, what is this?
Yeah.
Like, this is what, you know, I love New York, but this isn't what I want to. And I went home. I went back to my house. I had to get to rehearsal. I drove, you know, it's down by Princeton, so you drive two hours, whatever, to took this suit off, put my Converse on, and walked across the parking lot to rehearsal.
Yeah.
And I was like, there is no way I'm working. There's no way I'm working. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it.
What was the interview for?
Bozell Advertising.
Oh.
That was one of the questions he asked me. What? So do you want to do account, or do you want to do write? You want to do creative? And I was like, I don't know. What is it? I don't know what it is. Well, you don't know? You're going to have to know that if you're going to interview. Oh, fuck you. No, I don't. Or I just don't come into your industry at all and never have to learn it.
He was right, though, kind of.
Yeah. If you were serious, you should know the different departments.
Yeah, like maybe what you kind of want to do.
Yeah, you should.
Shed advertising. I don't know.
You shouldn't sit there probably a little high thinking, wasting his time.
Sweating.
In your bad suit, obviously sending signals that you don't want to talk to him.
You just came in to interview so you could throw shade at the fucking guy giving the interview. Teach him a lesson.
Right, exactly. You little arrogant, long-haired guy.
So you did end up working for your mom?
I did. I worked for her until I could make enough money doing stand-up.
So, okay, so you go back, and then you're doing shows in college, and then, like, how do you get started with the stand-up?
Well, right? I came out of school, and I was like, I auditioned for the Rutgers program, Mason Gross graduate program for acting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I didn't get it. I didn't get in. And I was like, well, I'll just get close to New York and I'll start auditioning, I guess. And I went into the city and I don't think I even auditioned. I didn't even have an act.
I never got there. It's so
nothing.
Weird. Like, it's saying you approach it the same way you approach the advertising agency. I guess I'll just look in the paper.
Yeah.
Someone will tell me what to do
and
or where to go.
That's what happened. I got like backstage, I got the Village Voice and I looked in the Village Voice and there was an ad for the New York Comedy Club that if you... you could have like an open mic bringer show situation. I looked it up and I was like, well, this is a phone call. Like, I don't need an agent. I just called the number and they said, okay, we have a show. You got to bring three friends or whatever. They could sit in the audience and we have an opening June 12th. And I hung up the phone and I was like shaking. Like, I'm going to be on stage in New York City telling jokes.
And you actually talked to Al Martin. It was probably Martin who answered the phone.
And I'm so
Al Martin, Kerry Hoffman, the people that unleashed the Bringer show on the culture of show business. It's their fault. Kerry Hoffman, the funniest pipe fitter in New York contest. The funniest dentist in New York contest.
And it's
bring
funny.
Nine friends and you can make a comedy record.
And we're going to charge them $75 each for drinks. Oh, so awful. But
so you had your date.
So I had my date. And I was shaking like a leaf.
Really?
And I started writing jokes.
That weird excitement.
This is happening.
Yeah.
Because I started, even in college, I had this job as a security guard where I would sit out in my car outside of a...
you had a job as a security guard?
Yeah. I would sit in my car in a housing development in the winter and just sit there. Nothing happened. It's the middle of like Windsor, New Jersey. Like there's no foul play is happening here, but they needed a security. So I would just sit there with a sandwich and my radio and I ran a heater and I would run a extension cord from one of the homes into my car and keep it warm and eat my Tuna Hero.
Yeah.
And just sit there for hours.
And that's where you wrote?
And that's when I started writing. I started writing and recording. I would write jokes because I'm sitting there talking to myself.
This is the job you were doing when you made the call to stand up New York Comedy Club.
This is before I graduated. This is like junior year of college.
So you just were writing jokes because you hadn't done a gig yet?
I hadn't done a gig yet, no.
Oh, really?
I'd never, no.
But you knew you wanted to, so that's where you would write jokes.
I would write jokes, and then I would come back and play the tape for my friends, and they thought it was awful. They thought, like, what are you, you're going crazy in your car by yourself. I'm like, but this part's funny. And they're like, come on.
You couldn't tell them the jokes?
Let's go to a party. Let's go get high. No, because I was recording it. I was getting them down. I don't know what I was doing.
You had no idea. A order up of you talking to yourself in a car.
Yeah, I'd listen back. That's pretty good.
You're your own audience.
Yeah,
you're just playing. Yeah, that's funny.
Like a psycho, like just by myself.
Yeah,
and so I just recorded and stuff. But I was kind of like writing jokes. So even though I hadn't performed before that June 12th show, I knew I needed jokes. I knew I had to kind of come in.
You knew that. You knew that much about this job. That,
like, yes, I'd never been to a comedy club, but I watched them on TV.
Right, and you're like, apparently for this job, you got to be prepared with something to say when you get to the job.
Yeah, you should probably. Yeah. Yeah.
So, which friends did you bring?
That I know. I brought my friend Jason.
Yeah.
And who's a madman, and the girl I was living with, Janine.
Yeah.
And a couple other friends.
Uh-huh.
And they sat in the audience, and I did my little jokes. And, you quickly...
How many people didn't know is that
you run out of jokes.
Quick?
So quick.
Yeah. You're up there about a minute or two?
Yeah, a minute or two, and I'm out.
Yeah. That's it. That's all I prepared for.
I got one really good laugh off of my one joke, and then I don't remember the others. And then...
That was it.
Started sweating and got out of there.
Yeah.
Talked to Geraldo.
Yeah. Was he there?
Watched Geraldo do his thing. And Geraldo had his, do you remember his joke about Catholics and Protestants, kneel, sit, stand?
Uh-uh.
He had this funny joke about what's the difference between.
Yeah.
Kneel, it's just the one kneels and one don't. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you do the Irish guy. These kneeling bastards, kneel, sit, stand, and then starts the whole war. And I was like, wow, this guy's a genius.
Yeah, yeah. He was kind of a very bright guy.
He was really bright, yeah. Super smart.
Yeah, yeah.
Too smart, in a way.
Yeah.
His head was a little too busy.
He was a lawyer.
Harvard Law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sad, that guy.
So sad. He would have been, I always thought that he would be our kind of, John Stewart, Bill Maher kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And like, if you think of the timing, like when Stewart leaves and then you have this really seasoned Hispanic comedian, accessible to white people, he could have slid right in there. It seemed like it was all set up.
He got rerouted by his own, by addiction.
Yeah, rerouted.
I had no idea.
No?
Not really. Not till way later. Like how deep in he was. I just didn't know.
Yeah.
I wasn't that close to him. I didn't live in the same town.
Right.
And by the time I heard about it, I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, because like, I remember one time I wanted to have him on and he was out here and I don't know, he's talking funny. Like he got loopy.
Yeah, really?
Like, he got paranoid and weird and, lack of sleep.
He would just go. He would go on benders. Like, for days. And
were you guys friends then?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
No, we were. I was tight with him the whole way. And but as these stories always go, even the people that are closest don't really know what's going on.
Right. Right.
And I would tell him repeatedly.
Yeah.
Just, you know,
because he tried to get sober many times.
Many times.
Yeah.
And he had a couple close calls where he ended up in the hospital. And I remember saying to him at one point, just, you know, you're going to crush me. Yeah. That's like...
Oh, if you die?
If you die, just so you know, I know you've got kids and there's more people that are important, more important than I am.
Yeah.
But just so you know, I should go on record as saying, it's going to wreck me. I don't know. I didn't know how to tell him. But he get very...
He's real
charming. Having friends you don't know. They start doing things you don't know. And...
they do, you mean?
They do. Addicts.
Oh, yeah. You're like, who's that guy? The weird-looking guy.
Yeah, who's the guy that you just left the club with?
My buddy. Yeah, so that guy. You know, they always... And that's always the guy that's there when you die and leaves.
Totally. Which is what happened.
Is it?
Yeah, well, he was in New Jersey, and he was clean. He was doing well.
Yeah.
And then he ran into some people he had partied with before.
Right.
And they just showed up and had stuff on them. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And they left.
They left, and he's alone in the hotel.
In a coma.
Yep. In New Jersey.
I remember when I heard of Vinnie Brandt, right?
Yeah.
The guy who went over there, found him probably. Fuck him
Yeah,
up.
Couldn't find him.
Yeah.
And went over to the hotel.
And they had to break the door down, I guess.
Yeah.
God damn it. So you knew and you tried and you didn't. That's weird because everyone's got their own life. You don't know the scope of it, you know?
You really don't.
But
as close as as much as we know. I mean, you know from doing the show.
Like, yeah.
You've had friends probably that are really close to you.
Sure.
That you never get to ask them questions until we're sitting in this scenario.
Right. Well, you don't know their life. I mean, you know,
yeah.
there's a community thing that we all have.
Yeah.
But you know, certainly once we get old enough to have lives, you know, you got to stay on top of that. You got to stay engaged and sort of like, yeah, we socialize with them, you know, once, three times a month. We go out, the kids know each other, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You got to stay in it.
You got to.
Or else, you know, like even if 3 months goes by and people are grown-ups, you're like, you did what? You killed a man?
Yeah.
When did that? You did jail time? How long has it been since?
Right.
You know.
Which, yeah, it's a good point. Like whenever like people are interviewed about the killer next door.
Yeah.
Well, of course, they always say we had no idea.
How would we know?
I'm busy.
Yeah.
I got the dishes are piling up.
We used to see him. He looked weird. He had a weird look about him when he's out in the yard.
Yeah. I didn't make eye contact. I want to get to the recycling and back in the house.
Yeah. We were uncomfortable, but we had no idea he was collecting heads.
Right.
But the illusion is, and I don't think it's an illusion. I think it's sincere when you spend that much time, like, you know, we as comics, whoever your crew was.
Yeah.
I mean, you're out all night, man. You're with them every night of the week. Your days are similar. You wake up in the middle of the day because you've been out till 4 eating and, you know, and doing the shows.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see each other like every fucking day for years. And you eat late at night. You talk about bits. You talk about women. You talk about, you know, whatever your dreams are, or whatever this or that. You talk about other comics. But that bonding, that's a real thing. So, like, you know each other.
Yeah.
But then, you know, all of a sudden it's like we have this assumption. And I think it's real. I think a lot of us know each other and we know each other from around.
Yeah.
But you know, you got to be part of someone's life to know their life.
Totally. You can know somebody's essence. Like I knew who you were.
Yeah.
Without knowing much about you.
Yeah.
Like I, you know, you, sure. You kind of knew what your vibe was, but you don't really know.
But you see, we see each other every, you know, you see people every week, you know.
Yeah.
But I guess that happens in real jobs too, you know, like every day they go to work. It's like that guy, I don't know, like I get him. I don't need to talk to him.
Right. Yeah.
So glad he doesn't work on this floor.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's like this camaraderie, but also, you know, like it was funny even just coming here. It's like, look at this.
Yeah.
After all this time.
He did all right.
I'm going to see Mark. We're both out here living in this place we didn't even think about in 98.
Yeah.
And it's funny. Like, you're almost like survivors.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's true, man.
Yeah.
You know, because you do see people fall to the wayside. You do see people die.
Yeah.
You do see people still struggling. And, you know, it is a survival thing, you know. And, and I don't, you know, and it didn't look good for me for a while. You know, so.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, those moments, like, it's so much nicer. Like, I have friends that know, that knew Jeff Garlin, like, really early in Chicago. And they don't have nice things to say because he seemed like aggressive and mean and whatever. I'm like, you met him when he's scratching and clawing, trying to find his way.
Yeah.
And now
he's still aggressive, but he hides the mean.
Yeah, but he's had success. So like, you calm down. You're like, okay, it's gonna be okay.
Well, that's a moment that's you should always be grateful for, I think. I have to, you know, because certainly for me and for anybody, really, it was definitely hard earned. It never came easy.
Right.
But there is that moment where you're like, you know, all right, I've at least, you know, achieved the ability to make a living and not worry as much. You know, if you're lucky, you find a groove, you find a niche, you find, you know, all of us kind of, you know, cobbled together a survival in show business.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the first few years you get a deal, you do this, you're on the road.
Yeah.
And you're not saving money really.
No, you're just getting by.
Yeah, and every time you had a little money, you're like, now you gotta hold on to that shit.
Yeah.
Because this could all go away. You know, I saw what happened to what's his name. I'm not gonna buy 4 cars and end up selling them.
I'm not gonna base my life off this one good year.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, that moment where you're like, oh, I'm gonna be all right. You know, like I'm old and you know, I might not die broke.
Right. Yeah, it's great. And it's great to see.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
That's true.
And also, and that frees you up. I, watching from the outside.
Yeah.
This thing freed you up. So I know it freed you up in a way that you could go and get that role on GLOW.
Right. And also as a stand-up.
As a right.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, there's a sense of calm and confidence
like,
that you can walk in and be like, I can own this major role.
Yeah.
Which when you're desperate and like fighting it, maybe you get in your own way.
Yeah, I think that was mostly because of my own show that I was able to do for a few years in relative obscurity. Yeah. I've had a lot of big, I've done a lot of the things I've always wanted to do in a way that no one's really paid attention to them.
Right, so quiet. I'm the same way. Technically, it's on the resume.
Sure, but you can't underestimate or underplay the experience part of it. Like, you know, doing my own show for 4 years, knowing going in, the first year was going to be dicey and I didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
But I was like, I've seen other guys, you know, bumble through this. And the good thing for me is nobody watches the network I'm on. So
for 4 years.
So I was quietly learning, getting a skill set.
How to do it.
And also because the podcast became successful, I didn't need to do anything else. I really don't. Right. So yeah, you're right. You know, once GLOW came around, I'm like, it's like at that point before it came, I'm like, whatever, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, we'll
I honestly don't give a fuck.
Yeah, I'll take the meeting.
But you had some kind of major movie stuff. Like I'd like to do some of the stuff you do in movies, but let's get to that later. So, so you start, so you're working around the city and then, when did you get in at the Cellar? What were the hoops you had to jump through to get work in New York? You were mostly working at Carrie's place and the comic strip?
Yes, exactly. I was doing stand up New York.
Yeah.
The comic strip.
Yeah.
Once in a while, Caroline's when you needed a tape.
Yeah. they had the tape right there. Comic strip had a tape too, but it always looked like some sort of weird surveillance thing.
Yeah.
That stationary fucking shot of the comic strip stage and everyone had that.
Oh, the bad lighting. And,
Oh,
so brutal. But it was so much fun. You were just doing it and trying to get good and trying to get good.
Yeah.
And I knew that the Cellar was like, I had a thing in my head, like you don't go to the Cellar until you are good.
Yeah. You can't sit at you can sit at one of the other tables.
Yeah. No, I didn't even go.
Oh,
I was,
really?
No.
I just remember that movement of tables. Like it's the corner table.
Yeah.
And then there was like two or three tables with those comics.
Right. Yeah.
The non-corner table people.
It really, someone asked me, like, a young comic asked me, like, so how did you know you wanted to do it? And it's like to get through, like, all those years of, I'm like, you don't. It just pulls you.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you stopped at any point and said, does this make sense?
Yeah.
You wouldn't do it.
You know, you really, in your brain, you don't have any choice.
No, you just go.
Yeah, it's like, what do you mean?
There's no evaluation. I'm like, I'm a comedian.
It's a rare thing. It's like, but not as rare as it used to be. But you know, that sort of like, I'm not thinking about anything else.
No.
It's completely consuming.
Completely. You know, I quit. Like I said, I quit for like 8 months. The girl I was with, her father passed. Mm. And it was just a heady thing. And I felt like I had to make money and take care of her. And I just stopped going into the city. And Geraldo would call me at my day job every day. Mm. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah.
I'm like, I just got some stuff I got to do. And, I'll be back. And he would call me every single day.
Really?
Every day. And in that time, in that 8 month time, I gained 30 pounds. I'm playing video games with my friends, just drinking.
What are you doing for money?
I'm working at my mom's advertising.
Oh, that's when it happened. Yeah.
And I'm working there. I don't know what I'm doing. But I do know that I'm getting fat and I'm drinking beer and getting high and just doing that and trying to convince myself that this is okay because I'm making money and we'll have a life, I guess.
The zombie life.
And I remember laying on my sister's bed one day at a family party and I said, am I funny anymore?
Uh-huh.
Am I?
To who? The wall?
To her.
Oh.
She. I could always make her laugh. And
yeah.
I'm like, am I even funny anymore? She goes, yeah, you're always funny, but, I don't know. Are you having fun right now?
That's what she said?
Yeah. And I realized I've got to get back, and I went back into the city, and that was it. I was like, I was literally doing the wrong thing.
That was your dark time.
It was making me like sick.
The dark time. Yeah. Working for your mom, drinking beer, getting high, and getting fat, just sitting around playing video games with your high school friends.
High school friends. That's exactly what it was. Thinking this could be okay.
Yeah, this is a life, and you're with a woman.
Yeah.
So what happened? You end up breaking up with her?
Yeah, we ended up splitting, and then went back into the city and just was like, it was like a second confirmation
right.
that this is really the only thing.
Geraldo would not stop pestering you?
He would not stop. And that was humbling because I've been doing it for a couple of years
yeah.
and getting decent enough.
Yeah.
And I would have to go, I went back. Like I could go at that point, I could kill on stage
yeah.
with whatever material I had.
Right. And you took 8 months off.
And then took 8 months off and now came back and couldn't get on stage and had to go to the Boston Comedies.
Sure.
Bringer show, like before, like not even the.
And Geraldo's working the clubs?
Yeah, and Geraldo's
right.
in. And
yeah.
I had to go and eat shit for 6 months. But I knew, like, all right,
yeah.
I just got to go back to work and get.
Yeah, get strong.
Get back to
yeah.
it. But it was hard to come back, even at that point. Like,
wow.
It was hard. Like, you're weak.
Yeah.
But I knew, like, once I came back, that was it. And then I got a gig for Doer Scotch where I was hosting. Basically, they're
yeah.
basically trying to get young people addicted to Doer Scotch.
Sure.
And they need a comedian to host and tell jokes. And I made like $700 for the week. And that's when I quit my job and jumped.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay. I just had in my head, I was pretty straight. Like I was like, I did have, I wasn't this.
Yeah.
I was an artist like to, but I also knew I had to take care of my shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because sure.
that was drilled into me. Like,
yeah.
keep an eye on your business. Like,
yeah.
you don't
right.
don't just jump without anything. So when I made that $700, I figured, well, it's more than I'm making doing.
And you knew that you could do this. I can host. Or I can. You knew that, you know, you weren't going to do what I was doing. You weren't going to, you know, push the envelope in a way that people don't like you.
What do you mean? Like, is your act?
No, I mean, well, yeah, sure. Like, you know, I think that it seems that your discipline around, you know, how you were going to do comedy was, you know, was likable. I mean, you weren't going to, you know, go up there and challenge people to like you.
No, that part of it, no.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
that's just who you are.
Yeah, I know.
That's just who, you know,
right.
I was...
I guess no one really does that. I'm a fucking idiot.
No, there are a bunch of
yeah.
people that, yeah, no, I don't like making people unhappy.
You know,
I don't.
Making the audience work?
No.
Like,
oh,
why does this guy have more of a shit together?
I don't like offending them. I make eye contact with everyone when I'm on stage. I want everyone to like me.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Before I was a comic, I was doing that. I just always couldn't believe.
Yeah.
When I found out that someone didn't like me,
yeah.
I was
yeah.
shocked.
How could that? Like, yeah,
and
me.
My
well,
friend.
Not Maron.
Yeah.
He doesn't like anybody.
Yeah, my friend literally was like, well, you know, everyone's not going to like you. And that really came as a surprise. So, yeah, so I was always just about trying to.
So you kind yeah. of built it and you started doing the jobs that we all do, doing the TV shows we all do, you know.
Yeah.
But then you sort of evolved, right? And, you know, you did a lot of Big Tonight Show guy, right?
Yeah, I did a bunch of those.
With Leno.
A few Lettermans.
Conan's all the time.
Conan, a lot of Conan's.
Yeah, a lot of Conan's. It was what we did in New York. You did Conan.
You
get that call from Paula. Do you have anything ready?
Yeah.
Cause
and
we
she
lost,
would be honest. She,
I know. Someone fell out tomorrow. Like George Clooney could not.
Yeah.
I'm filling in for Clooney. No, we're rearranging.
Yeah.
The
but you were like, that was impressive to all of us that all of a sudden you were going in and you were a regular and sitting there talking to him.
Well, I wanted to do panel. That was always my thing growing up. Like I'd see these guys do panel. It seemed to like be a more better way for me to work.
Right.
You know, because Richard Lewis used to do it. Those guys on Letterman,
uh-huh.
like Larry Miller and Jay and all those guys. You do panel. That meant you were, you know, you were
in
one
show
of the
business.
Guys. Yeah.
yeah.
So I just like became like adept at that. Like I could go
I remember
in there.
That.
Oh, I could go in there. It's different than a stand-up spot, which you sort of do have to prepare.
Yeah.
But like with panel, I could go in there if she called me on a day's notice with half-baked jokes.
Right.
With jokes that weren't full yet and that were funny enough to be conversational.
Right.
And just, you
and
know,
still funnier than the other people on the show.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
you
it
have
just
stuff.
Sometimes. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, I definitely had shit I was thinking about, you
yeah.
know, and stuff I was processing because during Luna Lounge days, you know, everything was sort of, I was halfway to jokes all the time. You know, I had things I was working on, and then they'd kind of pressure you to really make it work. And then I'd go on, and sometimes they wouldn't. Like, I mean, like, I would say.
But you did it regularly.
Yeah, 7 out of 10 times, though, like, the first thing would always fall flat, and Conan would be like, oh, here we go. Like, you know, like, yeah. I'd always say something where the audience would get nothing, and it just became a thing. That, like, you know, good way, nice to, way to alienate him right out of the gate. Like, in retrospect, I don't know if Smiley and him were setting me up. Like, you know, he's going to do that thing. We're going to just let him do this thing first. Yeah. He's going to get nothing, and then he'll struggle for the rest of it. It'd be great.
But you, yeah, I remember we were all like,
really?
Wow. Yeah, you knew how to sit. I didn't even know how.
Like, I think if you look at me closely.
How did you even know how to sit?
I'm slouching. Yeah, if you look at me
you cross your legs, you had your cool boots sticking out. I was like, this guy knows what he's doing.
Oh, my God. My impression of me was the opposite. Like, why am I wearing those boots? How come I'm not sitting up?
Of course. I'm shopping for boots.
Yeah. But how did you, like, where do you think you really crossed over into? Because at some point, you know, you became a very, you know, kind of efficient headliner with, you know, long form bits that were very meticulously structured. Was it, you know, was it opening for Seinfeld that did that? That really?
Yeah. I think meeting Seinfeld, no joke, was like, I always say that was like the big break.
Yeah.
Because I was doing stuff. I had had late night shots and I was doing it, but I was, you know, you're still very confused. And you don't know, you know, you're hanging out, I'm looking at you, I'm looking at Attell, you're looking at all these different people that aren't really what I am.
Right.
They work differently, they're living different lives,
yeah.
You know,
were you married yet?
No, I was with Cynthia, but
and she was a comic.
And she was a comic.
Yeah.
And we just started when I met him. I think I met her for like a
year.
What
was your maiden name?
Corey.
Yeah, Cynthia Corey, right.
Yeah.
I remember her.
And
you're still married.
Yeah.
Yeah.
18 years. These couple of years of like meeting her and meeting Jerry.
Yeah.
That was it. Really. It was good because she was
some grounding.
She was no bullshit.
Yeah.
And she came from where I came from and we had this kind of connection. And then meeting Jerry,
yeah.
Just having him first of all.
How'd you meet him at the cellar?
I was at Stand Up New York.
Oh.
This one week. I had 2 days in a row, I was on stage while he walked in.
Yeah.
Remember he was kind of circling the clubs?
Yeah, yeah.
He hadn't been on stage yet, but he was checking out everything.
Right,
and he walked in 2 nights in a row at Stand Up New York, and you can, from Stand Up New York, you can see through the
door.
Window, you can see who's at the bar.
Yeah, and you can see that fucking door when they stick their head in to the right, because it. Club is so fucking narrow and stupidly designed at the time.
It was so dumb.
Like people would walk in. You could see everyone in the fucking room, no matter how they put the lights. Yeah. Everyone. You could see waitresses getting
everybody.
Up. See you know, all the executives, whoever was there coming in the door, standing in the door, see him in the sound booth. It was fucking worst.
Yeah, and you're up there trying to survive.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really, it seemed so rough. But so he came in 2 nights in a row, and I switched my material up because I saw him there. And I was like, I don't want him to think I just do the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, just stupid ideas. But when I came off to the stage, he pulled me aside and said, you're really funny. And we started a conversation. And just him, Seinfeld, right off the show, coming, just give me that confirmation. And I just stuck around him.
Yeah.
And then at the Comedy Cellar, you know, all his guys were gone. The people he came up with, they weren't hanging out. So he knew Colin.
Yeah.
He didn't have friends like we had
like
friends.
Like the comic strip friends.
Yeah.
They weren't Comedy Cellar friends. He was a comic strip guy. So it was Mark Schiff and, you know.
And like, Reiser.
Right.
You know, all those people. Yeah. And they'd all moved on.
Sure.
You know, so he's coming back and there's all these. So I was like, just
join.
Don't
her.
Be annoying.
Yeah.
Don't be annoying. And Colin was friends with him and I would sit with him and Jerry.
Yeah.
And it just kind of, I soaked in everything because he wrote. Like I wrote, it was a confirmation that my way of working was okay.
Yeah.
Like that I sit and I like to write and I like to go on stage and then like rewrite it. And he wasn't really tortured. He was, you know what I mean? He was closer to me in personality.
Yeah.
And the way that he worked.
Yeah.
That really at that time gave me a confirmation like I'm doing there's validation that I can work this way and I can make it.
And that's interesting because I have like that sort of explains something about my reaction to you because I have the same reaction to him, is that I don't have no idea who that fucking guy is.
Right.
And I didn't necessarily resonate with comedy. You know, I understood that he was a great technician and everything.
Right.
And now, you know, like I literally did not, I didn't watch much Seinfeld. I was not, I didn't care about his stand-up. And it wasn't until I just watched that recent one where he goes back to the comic strip that I sort of got a sense of who he was.
Right.
And, you know, and I was right about him. For me, it's not my cup of tea.
Right.
You know, and just that, like, but, you know, you got to respect his craft and his talent and he's funny. But the way he approaches it, he literally says, I don't give a shit if they know who I am or like me. I'm here to see if the joke works.
Yes, he is. He's like a scientist the way he goes after it. But I felt like
you're more revealing.
I'm more, yes.
I mean, you talk about marriage, about your frustration, but there was that great joke that was sort of a Seinfeld joke, but oddly one of the jokes of yours I remember realizing that you were funny was that thing about the pillow, the stains on the pillow.
Yeah.
Like was our head leaking? What's the joke?
Yeah, it's you ever seen your favorite pillow? It looks like a Civil War bandage. Like a bandage from the Civil War.
But yeah, but you evolved into talking about, you know.
Can I tell you a funny story about that joke?
Yeah.
This is a name drop, but it's such a big name drop, I want to tell it.
Okay.
I did a gig for Clint Eastwood at his Mission Ranch.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I did a gig and they knew me, so they brought me in for this fundraiser.
Yeah.
And there's no food at the end of the night.
Yeah.
And we finished the thing and I said to him, is there any place you can get food? The restaurant on the property is closed. He goes, I'll get you something. Come on, let's walk around.
Yeah.
And Clint Eastwood and I, in the dark,
yeah.
You know, this is, you know, up there in Carmel,
walking
across a gravel driveway, like Josie Wales. And in the dark, Clint Eastwood says to me, you know, every time I go to bed at night, I think about your Civil War bandage joke. Is that surreal? I'm just like, that's it. That's it. I don't have to do anything
else. You succeeded.
You
won. You put a brain worm
right in Clint Eastwood's head. Oh, he lived for those moments.
That's great.
But it was just a confirmation that, like.
But then he asked you to open for him, and you've been like sort of his. You and Mario are like the guys, right?
Well, yeah, up until like the last 5 years, I worked for him solid for like 8 years.
And that's a good gig.
It's a great gig. I mean, the audiences are amazing.
You're doing 20, the 25,
gorgeous,
what?
20, 20, 25, yeah. Gorgeous theaters.
Yeah.
You're hanging with him.
Yeah.
And I just learned a lot about, you know, being a person, being a comedian.
Yeah.
Being, like, he's a very, he's very morally grounded. He's takes care of his stuff. He doesn't. He's not a.
Weirdo.
No, like, he's not a weirdo. There's no like
not
spinning off. Not out of control.
Right.
It's like
he's the opposite.
I'm not as dialed in.
He
as
is the opposite of out of control.
Yeah, he really is. So I learned a ton, and that was like at its core, just being around him.
Yeah,
you got things. You know, like, but just more as like the friendship of that comedian was super, super valuable.
I don't remember where we were. We were at some hotel. I think I was working in one room and you were opening for Jerry somewhere else. Was that in Vegas?
Yeah,
somewhere?
No, it was in Florida.
Oh, it was
at
in
the
Florida?
Hard Rock, I think.
Oh, God.
Yeah. You were playing the club and Jerry was playing the theater there.
The fucking worst.
It's a weird spot.
That fucking Hard Rock is the worst.
Walking from the hotel through that outdoor restaurant, Florida late night shit show. To the club was rough.
And I waited to do it. Like, you know, my I have family down there and I just put it off because I don't like performing down there for some reason.
Yeah.
And the audiences were like, whoa, who the fuck are these people? I got 12 fans there. This is before I built my audience. Yeah. And the rest is like, you know, like free tickets or I don't know what.
Yeah. I know. Birthday parties.
And just sweating up there. You're just like sweating.
It's so hard. I know.
It's like you do this for years and then, you know, you're going to hit those nights where it's like, this isn't landing. And I know from doing this that it's not going to.
I'm not riding this ship.
Yeah. And you get that sweat in the back of your neck where it's just that sweat of like, oh, this is like manual labor now. You know?
Yeah. And you've got shows you have to do there.
I just
got to
get through the job.
Yeah. Oh, that's a rough spot. And we had coffee.
Yeah,
we had coffee during
nice.
The day.
Yeah, it was nice to see you. And I think things turned for me and you. So how did you develop relationship with, because you did The Informant, and then you showed up in that great...
Behind the Candelabra.
Yeah, I love that movie.
The Liberace movie.
The Liberace.
So
good. Those are Soderbergh movies,
Soderbergh.
Right? And somehow he likes you. He likes comics or what?
Yeah, well, that he
somehow,
did
listen to me, still a little bit... sticking the knife in. Right. I don't know. I don't get it, but I guess that guy.
Why does he like you?
Yeah, what is that?
What does he see in you?
Yeah.
I auditioned. I got that one of the rare times when I actually auditioned for something and got it.
Yeah.
Was The Informant. Mm-hmm. He put a lot of comedians into that movie.
I remember,
he wanted the energy to be off kilter.
Yeah.
It's such a weird story.
Yeah.
And he said, I want every comedian has their own quirky energy.
Right.
And that will set a tone for the film.
Interesting.
And so I got that role, and then we just hit it off, and I just didn't suck.
Yeah. No, you're great.
And he put me in that, and he put me in The Nick, and worked on a couple things, and he's great. I mean, that talk about similar to the Seinfeld thing.
Yeah.
This is a very special guy.
Yeah.
Who works all the time.
Yeah.
He just purely wants to. Soderbergh is working on 8 things all the time. You leave him and you're just like, you just meet for a drink and you're like, I got to do more. Like,
yeah.
What am I doing with my time?
Yeah, right.
Literally.
Yeah.
And so I just really stuck around and, you know, again, don't be annoying.
Right.
And he saw that I could act, and you know, we just kind of, and he liked my stand up, which is
that's nice.
That's always,
I thought you were great in the Behind the Candelabra. It was a weird part. You were like, I can't remember, like a
I was
promoter,
his manager.
Yeah, right.
Me and Dan Aykroyd played his managers.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
I was
his
road manager. He was his business manager.
Yeah, I just thought that movie was pretty inspired. It's brutal.
Cool,
who are you talking to, Mumbles?
Yeah. Oh God, it's one of those things where you just know that I'm involved in something that's good. So many times you take gigs and you're like, I don't know how this is good. But you know.
Fucking Matt Damon and Michael Douglas were like just really fucking acting the fuck out of that thing. Like, I mean,
so
like,
good.
Because both of those roles are risky. They're vulnerable. They're mildly disturbing on an emotional and level. And they were so in it.
What was amazing, though,
yeah,
was watching them at this stage, both of them, such confidence in what they're doing, really knowing how to do it,
yeah,
that they weren't carrying this weight. Like, I was in a scene with Michael Douglas, and we're in the background.
Right.
And it's really Matt's scene up front. We're not even mic'd.
Right.
But we're in our big Liberace get-ups.
Yeah.
And there's Michael Douglas, like, Soderbergh's known for doing one take, maybe two, then moving on.
Right.
And it's going 3-4 takes. And Michael Douglas, in his Liberace voice, in the middle of the scene, turns to me and says, he's doing a lot of takes. I really got to take a dump. Why is he deciding to run this one long? You know what I mean? And Matt, too. Matt, at one point, we're all sitting at the table. It's a very emotional scene where he feels like they're breaking up.
Yeah.
And Matt's sitting there on his BlackBerry. He's making jokes and stuff. And I'm just watching him. I'm amazed by these guys. And, okay, we're going to roll. Matt puts his phone under the napkin and just boom. All of a sudden, from this joking around, hanging out, to tears, pulling your heart out, tearing at your heart, that he's breaking up with this guy and he's hurt and he's vulnerable and he's just... And then cut. Okay, hey. Back to making jokes.
No kidding.
They are so, they know, like what you were saying, how you learned after 4 years and then going, you started to get a skill set.
Well, it's interesting that Douglas stays in it.
Yeah.
And Damon can go in and out of it.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah.
I remember I heard a quote, it wasn't on that set, but I think it was an interview at the same time where Michael Douglas said when he was younger, he was like all like, you know, you had to really...
Yeah,
be balled up in your emotion, and you had to own it and feel it. And he said, "Because the camera knows when you're lying,
right?
The camera knows, so you better be honest and really know it." And then Michael Douglas said, "It may be able to tell when most people are lying, but I don't think it can tell when I'm lying. I'm an actor." And then he let all that emotional shit go, and he knew I can act. That
right.
is
right.
It lightened him up in a way.
Oh, that's nice.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, man. And so, but, you were in Chris's movie and analyzed that. Who were you
that
in
was that? My first movie ever.
What would you do? What'd you do?
I played in a jewelry store. De Niro's trying to go straight.
Yeah.
And he takes a job. He's trying to do these straight jobs after he left the mafia. And I play a guy shopping for his engagement ring. And I was with him for the whole day. Yeah. But that was the first movie I ever got. And Harold Ramis directed it.
Yeah.
And I went for the thing, and I get a call back.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I'm okay. I'm hit with my little scene. And he says, okay, so we're going to go in. You're going to go in. You're going to read. You'll read the part of whatever with Bob and thing. And we walk in, and it's De Niro.
Yeah.
I was thought Bob, the assistant, the intern. And I walk in, there's De Niro standing there with a script for my callback of the first movie ever. And I'm like, holy shit, okay. And then I start doing it, and I'm like really dialed in. I'm like, okay, I got to try. And De Niro's going off script, and he's fumbling. He's not like improvising. He can't find his way.
Yeah.
He's screwing up my audition. Right. Literally in the middle of audition went from I'm with a god to who's this asshole? Gotta ruin my shot. Oh, but I got it.
Got it.
I got it.
Was it fun? You're on set with him all day?
Yeah, the whole day. And after every take, they'd say cut, and a hair and makeup person would come on him like koala bears and just start going to work on him. And I'm just standing on the other side of this jewelry counter, you know, watching this.
Yeah.
And so I just started making jokes about my hair.
Yeah.
My hair. How's my hair? How my nails? How? And it was after like the fourth time of that happening to me, I was like, this guy really is worried about his hair. Want to take a look at his hair? Someone's got to take a look at this. This guy's really concerned about his
hair. He thought you were serious?
No, he was starting to bust my balls back.
Did he stay in character in between takes?
No.
Yeah.
No.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So you do a lot of guest shots on stuff. I can see that in the stand-up stuff. But you had that one show that you really put a lot of effort and work into, that marriage ref thing. And
yeah.
It seemed to, you know.
Seinfeld's only failure.
You tried and tried, and it didn't quite work. Didn't come together.
No, it didn't.
How many episodes did you do?
We did two seasons.
Yeah.
So
what was the problem? I remember watching it sort of like, what is the show exactly?
Yeah, that's exactly
like it. You had an idea, and then you're like, how do we integrate celebrities into it?
It was a lot of moving parts.
Right.
It was part reality show, part talk show, part game show.
Right.
It really never landed on exactly what it was, but you know, but that was okay. Like, it was supposed to be this little quiet Sunday night family show.
Yeah.
Taking people with their real problems and their real funny marital stuff.
Yeah.
And at that time when we were putting it together, Leno's show craps out on NBC.
Yeah.
So there's 10 o'clock open on every night of the week that NBC you mean, has
to
fill.
One they did to counterbalance Conan?
The 10 o'clock prime time show before the Tonight Show.
What a fucking clusterfuck that time was on television.
What a mess.
Huh?
Totally. What a dumb thing to do. You have the late show, then you take the old late show guy and you put him before the new guy at 10 o'clock. Doesn't work out. That craps out. So they have to fill 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And they come to Jerry and they say, 10 o'clock could be yours on Thursday night. Well, this isn't the quiet little Sunday show we thought it was going to be, but it's pretty tempting. It was a big mistake because then all of the marketing, and Jerry was also, didn't want to be front and center of the show either.
Right.
But now it's NBC and their wisdom. Seinfeld's return to Thursday nights. Jerry Seinfeld's back. And they start advertising the shit out of it during the Olympics.
Right.
And they just shoving it down people's throats.
Right.
And even when they're, I remember watching like the bobsled during the Olympics and they break out and they're like, Jerry Seinfeld's back. They weren't even showing me in any of the promos.
Right.
It was all Jerry. It was all comedy.
Yeah.
It was, you'd see my hands at the end of the promo. My wife was furious. But thank God, because the critics came after it like, this isn't Seinfeld part two. This is this weird show. Who knows what it is? Like, the critics were pretty rough on it. I, luckily, because the light wasn't on me, I didn't get beaten up.
You swinked away?
Yeah. I was just kind of like, okay, but it's a huge, it was a big thing. Jerry didn't like that it was all kind of coming down. He kind of stepped back in the second season. There's this other executive producer who is a shit show fighting with the network. The network hated her. And you know, first season went through Jerry's Rolodex of Madonna and Larry Dave and all. And now we've got, you know, road comics and stuff doing the show,
which
is really what it should have been.
Sure.
It should have just been funny people talking with these married people. Very funny. Like, people crave, married people crave that kind of a thing. They miss it.
Yeah.
But it was just a shit show.
Well, you survived it.
Yeah, it was good. And, look, it was good for me. The exposure was insane.
Yeah.
But I had no control over it. Like,
so you do all right on the road by yourself?
Yeah.
You know, right?
Yeah. I have my good audience.
Yeah, it's great. And then, you got a few of the specials and stuff you did. And now what the book is mostly essays about being a grown-up?
It's all about, it's about everybody. It's about family. It's about everyone in your life.
Yeah.
As a comedian, I've been watching everybody in your life. And it's broken down by mom, dad, brothers, sisters, fathers, cousins, uncles.
So these are actually
funny essays, bits? All about that.
Or there's new essays?
No, there's just new essays mostly. There's
it's called
couple,
Your Dad Stole My Rake?
Your Dad Stole My Rake and Other Family Dilemmas.
That's good.
It's my first book, yeah.
Well, congratulations. And tell me about, like, I didn't realize that you were in the driver's seat at Live From Here.
Yeah.
That is what, that's the new name for Prairie Home Companion, which is now populated with younger people.
Yes.
A new host.
Yeah.
Garrison has been put out to pasture for reasons. Yeah.
Well, he left before the kerfuffle. Before,
right.
But they changed the name because of that.
Oh, did they? And did they, how are the ratings of that thing? Still good?
Yeah, they're
What's
good.
What's the name of the new host?
Chris Thiele.
Oh, he's a
mandolin player. Amazing folk artist.
Yeah, it seems like it's all a bunch of folky country people.
We've had John Prine on.
I know. I don't know. It sounds great.
It's great. The music, it's like a revival.
I was about to say, I don't know why I haven't been on. I realized I'm not a musician of that.
You can come on it as a comic. Yeah. I would love for you to do it.
Are you
I'm in charge of the comedy.
Where's my time?
I would love for you to do it. Would you do it? Would you travel to do it?
To Minnesota?
It moves around. It's always in a different spot.
Yeah, sure.
You would?
I've got stuff that'll work.
I would love for you to do it.
Yeah,
we've had great people: Roy Scoville, Colin Quinn.
Yeah, I'd love to do it.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
So we have a comedian has a spot, and then I'm in charge of the writing.
Uh huh. And you still got some of the old timers there, huh?
Doing
the radio show scripts.
The two guys. Well, yeah, I'm in charge of the scripts now.
All new characters, though.
Yes.
Uh huh.
Yes. I always loved the show.
Yeah. I always listened to it once it was on, if I came upon it.
If you stumbled across it, which is the way it is now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you just hear, and I was just in awe of that Garrison created this world.
Yeah.
But I always had this sneaking suspicion, like, what would that be like in the hands of comedians?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's funny-ish. It's humorous. It's a humorist's take on it.
But also, he had an arc in his own sort. He had created this world, and you stay within the world.
Exactly.
And the pace was what it was. It was a comfortable pace. It wasn't.
Totally.
You didn't have to be like, oh, what's he want from me? You could hear it in the background and be like, oh, this nice music.
Totally.
Oh, that's kind of funny.
right.
Was it like Guy Noir?
Guy Noir. And he would do the news from Lake Wobegon.
Yeah.
And so when I got the gig, I was so... You did my radio show at Largo,
mm-hmm.
the Come to Papa show.
Yeah.
I remember you said, are you doing okay? You always get worried when a guy starts doing a scripted show.
On the radio.
On the radio. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm okay. And I was kind of like, and it was funny. Like, I was writing scripts.
Yeah.
I was doing my version of Prairie Home Companion, but with all you guys.
Right.
Which was so funny.
Yeah.
Everybody was really funny. We'd have music and stuff, not as good, but we would have funnier stuff.
Right.
So when Chris approached me through Flanny at Largo, I was doing exactly what they needed. For 5 years, I was writing scripts.
Radio scripts.
I knew exactly what had to be done. And I would watch Chris in that first season when Garrison was gone. And he's floating out there in these horrible 5 minute long, not funny.
Yeah.
It was death.
Uh-huh.
And I came in and I was like, we're going to make it funny. Let's come on. As a comedian, I wasn't writing like Garrison. I had a folksy kind of take to things, but I want laughs.
Yeah.
I want laughs.
And this is a weekly gig for you?
It's every week, yeah. So I appear on it every week. I do this segment called Out in America, where I report from wherever I am.
Uh-huh.
And either I'll record it or I'll go to a public radio station or like where they do Marketplace or something.
Do the ISDN?
While they're live.
Sure.
Or I'll go and I'll be in Chicago doing it. That's the best way to do it, but I can't get... I'm gigging, so I can't do it every week.
Sure. Do you have a staff of writers?
Yeah, there's like 4 writers that submit stuff. I took it over in September. The beginning of it was like, I couldn't believe I was standing doing a monologue where Garrison Keillor did Lake Wobegon.
Yeah.
It was big for me.
Isn't it in Minnesota? Didn't it used to be?
Yeah. It was mainly out of St. Paul.
So you don't have to travel...
No, if I can get there, I do. And if, but I've got my tour. I've got, you know, I'm
you're touring
stand up.
Now?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the tour?
Always touring.
Oh.
It's never, it's a nonstop.
I stop.
You do?
Yeah.
Really? Like a band?
Yeah, I mean, I just, I mean, I got to get, well, I got to get a new hour, you know, like I did the special last year and I just did five European dates with about 40, 45 new and then some stuff that no one had ever heard before. So it was new to them, but not to me necessarily. I probably should have toured I didn't do it right really in terms of, I just didn't want to do it. But like I had that hour that I eventually taped.
Yeah.
And I could have toured it, you know, for another 3 or 4 months, like really late into it before it was released, but I didn't.
But you won't go out with any of that material while you're
while
working
it's already
on the
out
stuff?
There. Not much. I tried to not do that because it just seemed to be like, you know. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But I just can't.
Well, first I can't stop touring. I can't. You know what I mean? Like I like it's what I do.
Right.
But I'm also very conscious of these people in Cincinnati's Saturday Night Out, and this is the one time they're going to see me. I can't just give them an hour of new shit.
No, but I mean, I'm not doing new shit that doesn't work.
Yeah, but right. But isn't there like a slow evolution of that happening? Like,
sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but like,
I'll just throw a bit in to get through the hour.
But this time, like, I really felt like this is the first time where I'm doing like, you know, bigger rooms. I'm selling, you know, I mean, in England, I sold over 2,000 tickets, you know, and I have to assume that a lot of them know me from this or that, but they had to have watched a new special. Maybe that's wrong.
But do you ever see people after? This is the modern day puzzle, by the way. But do you ever talk to people after the show?
And they wanted to see the bit that they. Yeah. No, yeah, I get that, and maybe I'll learn my lesson. But it really becomes sort of a challenge for me that like knowing that possibly. You know, that they will have seen it. It's like, God, it kills it a little.
I know, it does. But I could watch you do jokes that I know really well.
Right.
And enjoy it.
Yeah, no, I know.
And if I can, then the secretary in Peoria is going to be into it too.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'll learn my lesson. And I did it in Europe, but I definitely gave them, like, I didn't do the Rolling Stones bit. I didn't do these big bits that I was been doing.
Yeah.
But I brought back a couple of bits that no one had seen because I'd only done them on TV once or twice.
Right.
That were long bits that I worked months on.
Yeah.
And like a couple really old ones that, you know, you really had to, you know, dig deep to find them.
Yeah.
But they were great bits. And then I did like 40 minutes of totally new shit. And then I riffed.
That's great.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know.
But you're right. I might have disappointed some people. I don't know.
I wasn't saying that. Oh. But I do feel like, I don't know. We're definitely, I'm sure you've talked about this a lot, but there are a lot of bad specials out right now. Uh-huh. There are a lot of people rushing material out because they think that they have to do all new stuff all the time. And you know,
but I'm not going to do that.
No, I'm not saying you are.
No, I know.
But I find it for myself. I'm always going between this thing of, am I being lazy because I just want to kill this night, this Saturday night?
Yeah.
Should I be pushing it so like, it's all got to be new? But even, I mean,
well, that's
I'm not that good enough.
No, but
to put out completely new stuff all the time.
I know, but that's like, but also it's a difference in how you and I work. Like I was telling you, like, you know, like when I start to build material, I can't do it bit by bit.
Right.
You know, it's got to start to take shape as a whole.
Right.
So like that's like I was telling you, like I'll go do hours, you know, do a residency at Steve Allen or start working out, you know, hours here in town or go to smaller clubs.
You're thinking of it as this.
Well, yeah,
hour
sort
and
of
half
like
thing,
it's
got
to be a through line to it. Hour, like I'll start out like just fucking. I don't like this. Is the difference between writing like Seinfeld and writing like me?
Yeah,
is that I'm talking through things.
Right.
So I'll sell a cheap ticket to my fans and say like, you know, don't expect much. I'm processing, and I'll have them sit there for an hour and a half, 2 hours to start to find my way through this bunch of shit.
That's a valuable thing. I'm just so nervous about, you know, as a comic, like a joke. Can sometimes get really good 4 years in.
No, I agree. Like that's
right?
why I was doing.
And I feel
like
people are rushing shit, and you're not one of these. I'm not saying this about you.
No, but like that's what I was telling you about Conan is that I could go in with half of it,
right?
And then like you know, eventually it's sort of like a tag comes a year or two later, and you're like, all right, so what? No one saw it on Conan. Now it's a full joke.
So do you feel a need like? Do you have do you feel pressured to put out more specials now?
No,
because
I don't
of the
care
times?
About the special.
When it's ready, it's ready. When
you, well, yeah, I mean, I want to do one, and it's nice to know because it kind of puts a fire under your ass. But
right.
Like, what do I care? Like, you know, it's hard to get people to watch it. I mean, just gonna be one in a million specials.
I'd rather it be good.
Yeah, like the last one I did was there was an evolution. I think is the best one I've ever done.
Yeah,
I've done, you know, two for Netflix and one for Epics, and this is clearly in a direction where I have a lot more control. And I'm,
yeah.
But like, I can't rush the material. I don't know where it comes from or why.
That's my thing. And that's the essence of
yeah,
it.
Yeah. And right now I'm like, I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do. I didn't like when I took these dates in Europe, I'm like, what the fuck am I going to do? And
right.
Then like all of a sudden stuff started to, you know,
yeah.
To happen, you know, and now like I've been away from it for 2 weeks and I don't know if it's gone
it's
forever.
Right. Now it's totally lost.
I gotta,
but I do feel like that's important because I do feel like, and it's hard because there is pressure to have new content and stuff. But
well, it's just also, for me, it's just sort of like you want the opportunities. It's like it's not even like I feel like I got to get content out there. It's
right.
Just sort of like, you know, well, Netflix will probably do another one with you. I'm like, really?
Right.
Oh, shit. So how much are you going to pay me money?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you're like, all right. You know, whether it's out there or not, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, like people are, you know, at this point, I'm sort of like, well, you know, if they don't stick with me, whatever. I can't be, because like that desperation you talk about being alleviated.
Yeah.
Once you find some success for yourself, I mean, you can find it again. It's like, should I be tweeting more? Should I be on Facebook? I don't even use Facebook. Is Instagram important?
Yeah.
When can I get another special? Because I don't want people to forget that I exist. You know, I'm on this every day. Are people still listening to this? I don't know if there is. So like,
yeah,
you're going to find another place for the desperation and act.
Sure.
So like, you know, I want to try to, I want to try and stay in though. Like, I don't really give a fuck.
Yeah. Know,
but I still want to work, you know?
I always work from fear, 100% from fear
right.
And panic.
Yeah.
Which is good. But
I guess.
But I feel like when people ask, like, so when's the next hour? When's the next hour? And everywhere you go, every comic, I'm just working on my next hour. I'm just working on my next hour. It's like, how about you just work on your act?
Right.
And when the act is great,
yeah.
Then you'll do a special.
No, that's the way I really think.
Yeah.
And I've been fortunate in that it has revealed itself to me.
Right.
You know, fairly consistently.
Yes.
You know, like I've churned through a lot of shit.
Right.
But then I started to realize that there's some shit that I let die that I'm like, why am I not doing that? Like one of the things I brought out in Europe was like, I did this bit that took me 6 months to fucking make it.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's like, it's a long bit and it's like, it's just got a beautiful arc to it. And it was right when I started doing longer form stuff that had structure. And I did it once on like the John Oliver comedy thing. And then I'm like, got to retire that now. And like...
No.
I'm like, what am I? No one even saw that fucking thing.
No.
So like, I go to Europe and I'm like, I'm putting that thing back together.
Good.
Yeah, and
that's
I did.
Great.
It's a great bit.
That's great. No, I know. You know, and there is that kind of, it's almost, I always feel like, who do you think you are, Papa, that you think everyone in this room has seen
that's
that
the
bit?
Other thing. Like, yeah, when yeah. No one knew who I was, it's like, no, I've already done that on TV. It's like, so what?
Right,
like,
exactly.
No one cares.
You know how many people are out there?
I know now,
billions
especially. Yeah.
Watching this stuff. It's like, they should see your stuff.
And also after you've been around for a while, you don't know what the hell they know you from or why they're there.
No.
Or whether they get Netflix or anything.
No, exactly.
And
exactly.
I, you know, that's the other argument. It's like, I think there's an argument to mix it up. I think you should always show up with at least 20, 30 new.
Absolutely.
Right?
No, you should not be late. The era of just riding out your act for your career is long gone.
Yeah.
And as, you know, we couldn't do it.
I don't have that. I feel bad. I can't sell it.
Oh, no, you can't fake it that much.
All right, buddy.
This was really nice, Mark.
It was great. Great talking to you.
You too.
And congratulations, son. I think that's an interesting and fun show, that Live From Here, and I hope the book does well.
Thank you.
Good to see you, man.
You too.
That was great. I loved getting to know Tom after knowing him for 15, 20 years. I'm going to try to play some guitar in the new garage. Oh, yeah. Hear that? Hear that little... That's the sound of time travel. You hear that buzz? Hear that? That is the sound of like 1957. A through line. Tapped in frequency, a tube hum from an old Fender. And that is straight in Gibson 335 humbuckers. Yeah. Kinda in tune, right? Kinda.
Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.